Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we are brought to you through the good offices of www.patriotfamilies.com, a great group of people who truly understand and stand up for the fact that we are the nation, and believe with all their hearts the amazingly radical and new idea that Thomas Jefferson expressed in the Declaration of Independence, that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, our topic is self-esteem versus self-control. This topic has been at the forefront of my mind today because since I did not have any little miscreants in my ISS prison today, I was pulled to substitute for a missing seventh grade science teacher for 3 out of her 4 classes. In 2 of those classes, which were what we call collaborative classes, there was a special education teacher in the classroom with me, and we taught together. In 1 of those classes, I was the only teacher there. In all 3 classes, the children walked into the room discoursing loudly about whatever happened to flit through their delicate little brains, hugged each other, smacked each other, pushed each other, banged things on the desk. And it took approximately 10 minutes of the 55-minute classroom hour to get them quiet enough to be able to hear the assignment for the day. For the class where I was alone, I actually had to scream to be heard above the noise. And that was in the class that wasn't a collaborative class with special education students in it. Part of this was due to the fact that today was Valentine's Day, and there was a special deal that everybody could express their crush on their significant other by sending them a can of Orange Crush soda and some chocolates at the beginning of the day. By the time sixth period rang around, which was the non-collaborative class, everybody was on a major sugar high. And, of course, Valentine's Day doesn't do anything at all to mitigate the effect of middle school hormones. So it was a very interesting day. But I have substituted in seventh grade classes and sixth grade classes and eighth grade classes on days that were not Valentine's Day and had the same problem arise. Granted, when I went to school, I rode my pet dinosaur and my pterodactyl followed me to school. But in those days, even though we were a handful in middle school, everybody is, we did understand that the teacher should not have to scream at us to get us to sit down, take out our books, our pencils, and be ready to start the classwork assignment for the day. In the three classes that I taught today, two of them co-taught with a special education teacher, I had to repeat the instructions for the classroom activity more than six times because of the constant hubbub and the constant inattention and the constant noise. No one was listening to a word I said. We do a great deal in our modern progressive public education system, ladies and gentlemen, to promote the self-esteem of our students. According to our progressive friends, those kind, compassionate, benevolent people who created and run the Department of Education and managed to get anything at all from being a quadriplegic to having one eyebrow shorter than the other declared a disability, we are obligated to provide a free, appropriate public education to all students, whether they are capable of learning, capable of sitting still for 55 minutes, or capable of closing their mouths and not blurting out whatever passes through their head continually. As a result, especially in collaborative classes, you spend a good deal of your time merely attempting to get the attention of the people you are hired to teach. So, you have a one-hour classroom. It works between 55 and 60 minutes, depending on how your particular school system schedules things, to impart the knowledge these children need to be able to go on to further levels in school in the four basic core areas of math, science, social studies, and language arts. Out of that 1 hour in class, 10 minutes of it at the beginning are spent attempting to get everybody to shut up long enough to find out what they're going to do that day. Another 10 minutes is spent repeating the instructions because nobody is listening the first five times. And another 10 minutes is spent at the end of the class trying to get them to complete their work, clear their desks, pack their backpacks, sit quietly, and wait to be dismissed. So, basically, out of that 60-minute hour, you have approximately 30 minutes of actual education time. If you talk to people in the business world who are hiring, God help those poor people in the business world, youngsters fresh out of high school and many fresh out of college, with this kind of background in an academic situation, is it any wonder that you have thousands and thousands of unemployed young people joining the Occupy Wall Street movement? We are supposed to be preparing our children to take their proper place as productive, happy, concerned, and educated citizens. We are supposed to be giving them the academic skills they will need to further their educations on the job or with higher academic pursuits. My friend Bill, that's perfect, Bill. He's got a series of smileys in the chat room. We start out with a smile, Then we start out with a glare, and we finally end with a screaming temper tantrum, merely to get somebody to pay attention to the fact that there's a teacher in the room. Now, kids that grow up with that as a place of learning, can we expect them to be able to focus well enough to even listen to the instructions of their supervisors on the job? How many people do you know, ladies and gentlemen, who have had to explain procedures 15 to 20 times to an employee because the employee has never learned to listen? Granted, middle school kids very rarely think above the waist. And on a sugar high on Valentine's Day, you might as well forget it, particularly by the time sixth or seventh mod rolls around. But if this had only been an anomalous experience, and the usual classroom got at least 50 minutes of education, I wouldn't have wanted to bring up this topic tonight. But it isn't just Valentine's Day, and it isn't just the usual hormonal burst that you deal with when you're trying to teach 12 to 14-year-olds. This is an epidemic of total chaos in our classrooms. I had a student in ISS this week who is a nice young man. He really is. He's a good-hearted soul. He tries hard, but he has absolutely no ability to engage brain before opening mouth. He cannot abide by no talking. Everything just bursts out. And this is tolerated because this particular student has an IEP, an individualized education plan. This particular student happens to be have been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. He's also dyslexic. Well, I have a stepdaughter and two grandsons who are ADHD, and I'm married to a man who is dyslexic. And any one of those four people actually knows how to listen. And I don't have to scream at any one of them for them to pay attention to what I say. It makes me wonder just how much of what they are doing in class is the product of home training, and how much is the product of a system that basically eliminates consequences for indecorous behavior and actually actively rewards it by allowing a student to take a quiet time break in the hallway when they're bored silly and are busily tormenting somebody so they'll get kicked out of class. My friend Linda asked if we still have chalkboards and that I should write the word decorum up there and get everybody to define it. It's a great thought, but by the time they figured out which book was a dictionary and realized that D comes after C, it would probably take about 45 minutes of the class hour before anybody learned anything about science or math, history, or language arts. And that's partly because of the climate of non-listening. We live in a nation that values its right to freedom of speech. We are passionate about our right to speak our minds, come hell or high water, to all and sundry. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is generally a good thing. It's a better thing if you actually have something to say that's relevant to the situation upon which you're commenting. Most 12 to 14-year-olds don't have anything relevant to say regarding science, math, language arts, or history. The major freedom of speech that they wish to enjoy is gossip about who is dating who, where they're going for the weekend, what the latest video game is like, and did you hear that such and such did so and so to something else? He called me a name. You've got to make him behave, Mrs. Rowland. And you spend so much time dealing with that, that by the time you're finished with one class, the only thing you can think of is, oh, please, God, let me out of here and pour me a stiff drink. It is no wonder, ladies and gentlemen, that the vast majority of fresh-out college education majors who enter the public school system to teach don't last longer than 5 years. When you have spent 16 years of your life learning things to impart to others, and you walk into a classroom in which everyone ignores you unless you scream, would you want to stay? You have to be crazy to do it. My friend Linda said that in her day, and it was my day too, when the teacher gave an opening start to the lecture, there was a question and answer period afterward, after the assignment was described, and when the teacher opened the floor for questions. And when students had a question, they raised their hand, they were called upon, and they had the floor to express it. Well, now, everybody just blurts out anything. And the funny part of it, ladies and gentlemen, the really funny part, is given that my job usually is in the in-school suspension room, where no talking is allowed and where everybody has to raise their hand to ask anything, including may I go to the bathroom, 9 out of 10 of my kids tell me they really like it in there because they can actually get their work done. Oh, my God, what a revolutionary concept. Our current classroom environment is the result of that beloved idea of the thoroughgoing educational progressive, that there is no bad behavior, there is only communication we don't understand. That is the most idiotic mantra upon which to base the education of children under the age of 18 that I have ever heard of in my life. It is blatantly untrue even of adults. There certainly is bad behavior. Deciding to go and steal other people's cats so I can eviscerate them while they're still alive and sacrifice them to the devil is bad behavior. I'm sorry, it's not communication. It is bad behavior. Jumping up in the middle of class to go dump something in the wastebasket and talk to your friends on the way while the teacher is explaining the assignment is not communication, ladies and gentlemen. It is bad behavior. I do feel compassion for people who suffer from Tourette's syndrome. That is a neurological disorder in which the individual has no conscious control over certain types of bodily and verbal tics. They will burst out with profanity or make odd noises or have muscle movements, facial movements, etc., over which they literally have no control. 99% of the students who are diagnosed with behavioral disabilities do not suffer from Tourette's syndrome. They suffer from the, it's not your fault, poor little thing. You just do what you need to do, and we'll make sure you're accommodated. So you have the same rights as everybody else, and everybody will like you. And if you think I'm jaded and you think I'm making this up or that I am some mean, crotchety old witch, well, the last part's probably true, but the other two aren't. It is quite true. And no, I am not jaded. I am experienced. And I continue to do what I do because I feel that I have something valuable to contribute to our future, which is exactly what I'm helping to create. Because the lives I interact with in the classroom, they are our future. Our founding fathers understood that we cannot be a self-governing nation if we are not a nation of self-governing individuals. They understood that teaching self-control and understanding that our acts and our words have consequences were essential to create an adult citizen who could truly elect representatives who would govern with the consent of the governed and do what the people required of them. We are raising generations. It's more than one now, ladies and gentlemen, because this has been going on for over 30 years. Generations who have no understanding that what they want at any given moment is not always going to be theirs immediately. who have no ability to think before they act or speak, because they have been trained to believe that they are not required to do that, that self-control is a cruel repression that deprives them of self-expression and their individuality, which is oh so precious. And it damages their delicate egos so that they become withdrawn and afraid of the world when harsh words are used. Any teacher nowadays who becomes frustrated enough to use the phrase shut up will be called on the carpet in the principal's office, receive thousands of emails from irate parents, and very likely lose his or her job. I remember being in classes where we were told to shut up. And when it got to that point, we did, because we knew the next step was off to the principal's office. And the principal's office employed the Board of Education. You know, not the group of people who make all these nice little laws, but that nice flat piece of wood with the holes in it that was vigorously applied to the gluteus maximus of the offending student. I am not in favor of corporal punishment as the standard operating procedure for any misdemeanor in school. I think it's excessive for many small things, but I think it's a fine deterrent for major ones. And unfortunately, because I think this, I will undoubtedly be labeled as a cruel, vicious, abusive sadist. Unfortunately also, ladies and gentlemen, our progressive, brilliant ideologues in the field of education have a Janusian view of young people. If you remember the Roman god Janus, after whom our month January is named, he was the two-faced god who looked forward and back at the same time. Well, being a god, he could manage to navigate and ambulate with that handicap, but we can't. Yet this is the progressive attitude toward children. On the one hand, they are potentially dangerous criminals who, if they have any emotional problems at all, we must watch them carefully because they will shoot 20 or 30 children when they're 18 or 20. Or they are angelic cherubs who must be loved and nurtured because there's no bad behavior, only communication we don't understand. Well, I hate to tell you, we are not capable of going forward or backward like the god Janus. We cannot look both ways at the same time. We cannot treat our kids as if they were perfect models of decorum, no matter what they did, and praise them for acting like idiots, and then turn around and jump on them the minute they turn 18 because they don't have the control to understand, no, you can't rob a bank and get away with it, and you don't get a do-over if you kill somebody. If you are going to have a population in which respect for law and respect for others is the paramount motivation for societal interactions, you are not going to get it by indulging children for 12 to 16 years and then telling them, bad, 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 we're now going to shoot you. It's kind of like raising a puppy, folks. And no, I don't want to treat kids like dogs, but we raise puppies with more common sense than we raise children, particularly in school. When you have an 8-week-old puppy, and you really do not want your puppy to use your living room rug as its toilet bowl, when puppy does an inappropriate action on the rug, you rub puppy's nose in it so he knows what you're talking about. You smack him on his delicate little butt so he feels uncomfortable, and he associates that discomfort with what it was that he did. And after a few smacks and a few nose rubs, he figures out that that's not something he's supposed to do and remembers to tell you he wants to go out by scratching at the back door. Especially if you praise him when he scratches out at the back door and you praise him when he does his business outdoors with you on a leash or in the backyard. It's very simple. And you can do exactly the same thing with children because their cognitive ability And their moral sense is about at puppy level until they get to be about 16. And some of them never get past puppy level at all. Obviously, I am not going to take a child by the scruff of the neck, rub his nose in a box full of chalk, and smack him on the butt. Well, first of all, I'd be arrested for child abuse and assault. And secondly, I don't mean it literally, ladies and gentlemen, but metaphorically. When behavior is inappropriate or disruptive, and no negative consequences result, why is everybody surprised that the disruptive and inappropriate behavior continues? We are not born with a moral sense. Study any feral child, and there are some, not a lot of documented cases, but there are some. Feral children, all the way from Rudyard Kipling's Mowgli and the Jungle Books to actual feral children who have grown up in wolf packs or coyote packs or in the woods, their moral sense is, what can I get into my belly without getting hit first? We are taught morality, ladies and gentlemen. We are taught social interaction, appropriate behavior. We are taught that our acts have consequences. Positive actions, positive consequences. Negative actions, negative consequences. Self-esteem does not come from being patted on the head when you kick the teacher and being told how much you are loved, even though that wasn't very nice. And I know that's been done because it happened with my own grandson. He did it and got pulled into a corner to have a game played with him and given a treat so he could relax and think good thoughts before he went back to class. And when his mother, horrified, discovered that this was the way his tantrums and hitting out were being treated, asked why on earth they would do this. All the teachers and guidance counselors and everybody, we just want him to feel that he's loved. Well, he may be loved, but he's not liked very well. And that's the other thing that self-esteem versus self-control gets confused. It's that progressive inability to understand that words mean things. And that liking and loving aren't the same thing any more than equal and alike are the same thing. I love my kitty cats. I love them very much. They're warm and they're furry and they curl up next to me and they purr and they welcome me when I come home. But when they jump on my computer table, spill my tea all over my mouth, and drench my keyboard, I don't like them very much. And they get a dose of cat discipline, which is a spray bottle of water, which they don't like, and understand that that was not good behavior, and every time I take out the spray bottle, everybody goes off somewhere else and behaves themselves. And as we all know, cats are notoriously indifferent to don't do that. No cat in the world has ever gotten over the fact that they were once worshipped as gods, and as far as they're concerned, they still are, and we are their acolytes and handmaidens. But they do understand negative consequences, and generally, negative consequences make the cat a much more pleasant housemate. Why are we raising our children more poorly than we raise puppies? Why are we expecting some cosmic agency to all of a sudden tap them on the forehead and give them moral sense? My friend Linda says cats have way too much self-esteem, and she's right, they do. They are a bundle of self-esteem with fur on top. And I love cats dearly. I have six. You know, I have to love them. Nobody in their right mind who didn't like cats would have six of them. But I am well aware that as far as they're concerned, this is their house and I am staff. We get along because I don't expect them to behave like human beings. However, I do expect children to at least be taught how to behave like human beings who use reason and logic and the understanding that for a society to remain viable, there have to be rules of conduct. Rational anarchy, ladies and gentlemen, is a wonderful political system if you can handpick the population that lives under it. Robert Heinlein's novel, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, is a good example of working rational anarchy. But of course, the population of the moon colony, where rational anarchy is the rule of the day, are all highly intelligent, extremely qualified, very knowledgeable people. They are not anybody and everybody from broken homes with everything from Down syndrome and autism through Tourette's syndrome and behavioral disorders. It means they scream when they don't like things or they start rocking back and forth and kick people. You are not going to get rational anarchy to work in a classroom. Kids are not going to develop an understanding of morality, ethics, and appropriate behavior if nobody ever teaches it to them. And this is where we are now. We are expecting our kids, without instruction, without consequences, without common sense, to go through 12 years of an educational system that makes excuses for every inappropriate behavior they exhibit. Their self-esteem is amazing. In a study done with, I think it was about 10 years ago, American high school students scored highest in self-esteem in the world. The fact that they were 27th in academic ability didn't bother anybody very much. Their self-esteem was great. Well, my self-esteem may be great, but that doesn't mean I'm going to be able to hold a job if my self-esteem gets in the way of doing what I'm told by my boss. And everybody works for somebody. That's a line from a John Wayne movie called McClintock. I don't know how many of you ever saw it. And, of course, that one doesn't show very often because nasty John Wayne paddles Maureen O'Hara. Spouse abuse! Of course, the fact that she deserved it is, beside the point. But anyhow, his daughter, he's a very wealthy rancher, John Wayne's character. And his daughter has come home from college. And he is talking to her out on a hunting trip. And he says to her, "You probably think that I'm going to leave you all of this," meaning a ranch the size of Arizona. And she says, "Well, Daddy, I never really thought about it." And he says, "Well, I'm not. When you find the man that you want to spend your life with, I'm going to give you a small spread, the size my mother and I started with, and a small herd of cattle, and let you experience the bond that forms between two people with all that working and living and loving and growing together." The young man she picks is the son of a deceased sodbuster and has a widowed mother and isn't rich and isn't powerful or anything else. But, and he says to the girl's father, "Well, I hesitate to court your daughter because I'm not important. I just work here." And John Wayne's character says, "Hell, son, everybody works for somebody. I work for all those people back east who want to eat beefsteak for dinner." And it's those ideas, ladies and gentlemen, that we used to keep in the way we dealt with the world. The idea that we all work for somebody, that every single one of us has to start with our own abilities and work our way up from there. Those were core values in our society. They still are for the vast majority of the country, particularly for those who live outside the beltway and away from large urban areas. I live in a rural county, And around here, we say we live on river time. Because the river gets there eventually, and so will we. But we also know that no matter how much self-esteem you give it and how much you tell it you love it, the seed you plant is going to grow instantly. It's going to take its time, because that's the nature of seeds. And if it doesn't grow, all the loving and petting and telling it it's not its fault are not going to get you a potato at the end of the growing season. It's going to get you a hole in the ground with a dead seed in it. Common sense isn't dead. It's only asleep in the major population centers of our nation and in our nation's capital. We operate on common sense. Those of us who go to work in the morning, do our job to the best of our ability, treat our fellow human beings as we wish to be treated, come home at night to deal with family responsibilities, and try to leave the worries of work at work so we can enjoy the family when we get home. Those core values, that understanding that we get what we earn, and that earning it is what gives us self-esteem, were very rarely spoken of because they were taken as common sense truth. We weren't lectured in school about citizenship, per se. We weren't lectured about anti-bullying. We weren't lectured about multiculturalism or how evil it was to tell somebody to shut up, or how bad it was to get in a fight because you might hurt somebody's feelings, even which is even worse than actually giving them a bloody nose. No, we weren't taught those things. We were taught at home and at school the values that I codified earlier. You get what you earn, and the pride and accomplishment of having earned it is true self-esteem. Nobody can give you self-esteem. Giving you an A because you didn't pee on your next-door neighbor in class last week, when you can't distinguish the letters T and Q, is not going to give you any self-esteem. It's going to give you an inflated ego, like the gentleman in the White House. And we can see where that's got us. Self-esteem is not ego, ladies and gentlemen. Our public school systems are inflating egos right and left, but they are doing absolutely nothing to engender true self-esteem. Because they are doing absolutely nothing to engender self-control and respect for others. If we don't stand up and start speaking out about this, we will go further down the road to the, I guess you could call it, penal servitude in the novel Agenda 21. And I strongly recommend, ladies and gentlemen, that you read that book. It takes the UN's view of the utopian Earth to its ultimate, quite logical, conclusion. The Earth is sacred. The animals are sacred. The plants are sacred. People are an excrescence, and they are only here to serve Gaia, the sentient Earth. They must live energy neutral. Their calories intake must equal exactly the power output, which is generated by being chained to a bicycle power generator for 8 hours per day. And if your energy production falls off, your calories are cut. That is the kind of world that what we are teaching our children now will lead to. Because our children have no understanding of consequences. They hear the sweet, juicy, delicious sounding apple, and they don't take time to cut it open and see the worm in the middle. Because they can't actually listen. Listening is not just hearing. That's the other problem with the progressive's inability to distinguish the meaning difference between two words that are similar in their context. Hearing and listening are not the same thing. Listening requires effort on the part of the listener. Hearing is an automatic, autonomic nervous system function that, unless you have a birth defect or have accidentally had it taken from you, you can't help but do. Our population, 51% of it, that gave a second term in office to the current individual in the White House, is very good at hearing, and they are very poor at listening. And they have been made poor at listening because they have been taught subliminally all through their school years that listening is unimportant, that talking about something is more important because that means they have freedom of speech and they're an individual and they're a grown-up. I am probably a little crazy. Don't tell anybody, though, because obviously if I am, somebody's going to come and tell me I'm not allowed to apply for a concealed carry permit or even own a weapon. But let's put it a little bit better, because so far I don't think that this puts you on the list of no, you can't have a gun. I'm eccentric. How's that? I'm really not wealthy enough to be called eccentric, but the eccentricity that I have is called crazy, and quite crazy by progressives. And it's understandable because their version of sanity is the opposite of mine. Their version of sanity is what I call total madness. And even though I'm a little eccentric, okay, doesn't mean that I am mad in the certifiable institutionalizer immediately sense. I'm eccentric because I happen to believe that common sense is valuable, and it isn't very common, particularly in our current climate of divisiveness in this nation. I have said before on this show, ladies and gentlemen, and it's a truism that I will repeat, and I know you're tired of hearing it, but it still has to be repeated. The best way to keep a population under control is to keep them ignorant and afraid. And our public schools are doing that to our kids. Not afraid in the sense of being afraid they're going to be whipped if they chew gum, or beaten to a pulp if they speak out in class, or shot if they, make a mess in the bathroom. I'm not talking about that kind of fear. I'm talking about the fear of being politically incorrect, the fear of not being part of the in crowd, the fear of being thought odd or unusual or different. Because after all, we all must be part of the group. Because in the group, there is safety and progress. The ignorant part is pretty self-explanatory. If you've ever watched some of the more conservative talk show hosts and interviewers and commentators, when they've done polls of young people, people under the age of 40, and that's young to me, and ask them questions about how the government runs and who the president is and what the legislation that's being talked about in the political arena is about, and what the Constitution is and how many amendments there are and what's the Bill of Rights and who wrote the Declaration of Independence. And they have no clue. It should be pretty obvious. The ignorance is well along the road. Our kids have been basically induced to believe that anything that I can't put on my iPhone and have 50,000 likes is totally unimportant and unnecessary to know about. My friend Linda always has a good quote from Thomas Jefferson. When the people fear their government, there is tyranny. When the government fears its people, there is liberty. Jefferson was truly a brilliant man. I always remember John Kennedy's remarks at a dinner given at the White House for winners of the Nobel Prize, when he said, "This is the most brilliant gathering of people for dinner in this White House since Thomas Jefferson dined alone." The pathetic part of all this, ladies and gentlemen, is that we have allowed it to happen. Not because we wanted it to, not because we didn't care, but we became complacent. We became comfortable. We started to believe that we were entitled to all the wonderful things we experience in this society, and that nothing could ever take it away from us. That our fellow citizens were as happy about the way our country runs as we were. And that our public schools were educating our kids to be productive, happy citizens with minds of their own, who understood the issues when they went into a voting booth, paid attention to what their elected representatives did, and cared about knowledge for its own sake. We believed those things. And because we were naive, and because we are, by the nature of our society and the laws under which we live, a compassionate people, we didn't see the unintended consequences of the huge tentacles of the federal government strangling our public schools. The more centralized power a nation exerts, the less freedom its citizens have. The novels of dystopian societies are very popular these days. Divergent, The Hunger Games, Agenda 21, Michael Vay, although that's not a divergent society, it's a divergent society in the making, a dystopian society. And the reason that they're popular is because the climate of comfort and a belief in the viability of the American dream has been severely shaken. Because progressives have, slowly over time, convinced a very large number of people that the American dream is a promise and a guarantee. Did anybody ever promise you a dream? Nobody ever promised me one. I grew up understanding that a dream, aside from the one that you had at night with your eyes closed, was something that you wished for very much. That, wow, wouldn't it be wonderful if that could happen? It wasn't, I'm going to get that because I'm entitled to it. That wasn't what a dream was. A dream was a fantasy, if you will, a wonderful thing that you wished very much you could achieve. And if you cared enough about that dream, you worked your little tail parts off to try to make it reality. You didn't stand there and say, oh, I had this wonderful dream, give it to me. I certainly didn't. Did any of you out there listening do that? Did you see the American dream as something that everybody was guaranteed they were going to get no matter what they did or didn't do? In the 60s, the phrase American dream, instead of meaning the possibility that freedom gave, got tarnished by my generation, the make love, not war, tune in, turn on, drop out crowd, as a kind of old snide description of one's parents. If you remember the Monkey song with Mr. Green, he's so serene, he's got a TV in every room. It was that idea, that the American dream was pure materialism, and that people who bought into it were stupid, greedy, closed-minded bigots. Well, I never thought so, but of course, given the fact that I did go to college in the 1960s, I'm tarred with the same brush. I have to admit, that was my generation. Wasn't me. I think I came out of the womb as a conservative. I never even flirted with, you know, Marxism, communism, etc. But I said before, I'm eccentric, so, you know, I'm just telling you the truth. But that idea, the American dream, which had meant that symbol that the Statue of Liberty stood for, and that Emma Lazarus so aptly described in her poem, The New Colossus, send me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Send these tempest tossed to me. Slightly out of context and out of rhythm, but that was the whole point of that New Colossus. It wasn't a guarantee that you could have everything you wanted. It was a guarantee that you could have the opportunity to try to get it. That was the American dream. Not a TV in every room, two cars in the garage, 2.5 children in a station wagon. That's the 1960s hippies. I hate mom and daddy because they're just so stodgy and they won't let me, you know, go to Woodstock version of the American dream. The real American dream was what our public schools were created to make possible. They were to be the great leveler. They were to be the chance for every child, no matter what his or her economic background, ethnicity, religious persuasion, race, every child had the chance to learn and get the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic upon which they could build that American dream. Because very few uneducated people wind up with that American dream, and that is even more so the case now. In our technological world, you cannot even get your fingernail tips on that American dream without a solid education. And that solid education does not include using your calculator to subtract 5 minus 3. So that your self-esteem won't be wounded because you have no clue how to figure out that 5 minus 3 equals 2 without the calculator. Don't get me wrong, I like calculators. If they'd been around when my husband was in college, he'd have been probably have a PhD in engineering. But arithmetic and my husband have never gotten along. And if calculators had been around, he wouldn't have been held back by the fact that he's dyslexic. And that when he adds a column of figures and it comes to 21, he puts down the 2 and carries the 1. His understanding and his ability to visualize three-dimensionally and then create what his mind has visualized amazes me. I can't do it. I don't have that talent. But boy, the calculator would have been a godsend for him. But he did have one thing that today's students are not getting. He had parents who, when he was discovered to be dyslexic, told him, yep, this is going to be hard for you. That means you're going to have to work a little harder than everybody else to get it. They did not tell him, you can't help it. We'll make it so you don't have to read. They didn't tell him, it's okay for you to get frustrated and throw things. We understand that you're just communicating how frustrated you are. Oh, no. He and his brother called their mother Baba-san, which is Japanese for old witch, because the hand was quicker than the eye with her. Mouth off to mama, and you got a smack right across the chops. And it didn't matter whether you were dyslexic or not. There was no, oh, poor baby, you can't. We understand this is just communication we haven't quite gotten yet. Oh, no, didn't go on in my husband's family. Didn't go on in my family either. And because he had parents who did not use the pity party to hold him back from his full potential, when he started acting up in middle school, fortunately, they were well off enough to send him to military school, which was absolutely brilliant. He got straight A's his first semester because his dad had promised him reluctantly that if he did that, he could have his own car and his dad would pay for it. And knowing my husband, he wanted the car. So he got the straight A's and never fell away from that during his entire time at military school. Graduated, I think, what was it, second or third in your class here? He's a brilliant man, which is one of the reasons why I married him. But if he had been in school now, that brilliance would have been shuttled off into resentment and frustration and a lot of other things that would have produced absolutely nothing. Instead of three beautiful daughters, a business, and a very contented wife. Because nobody told him that he didn't have to try. Nobody played the pity party for him. And as a result, he is one of the strongest and most honorable men I know. I have so many kids, ladies and gentlemen, who are decent, honest, well-meaning, kind-hearted kids who have learning difficulties and who really, really want to know things and learn. And they want to feel good about accomplishing things. And they try. But they are in classes with people, with kids whose parents, oh, poor lamb, no, no, you got to give him an A. He can't help it that he spits on people and has to be removed from class three times in an hour and throws things. He's entitled to a free, appropriate public education, too. And the poor little sucker who has difficulty learning and who needs a structured environment so he can get the help he needs, he gets tossed out with the bathwater. And most of the kids who have learning disabilities are actually brighter than average, IQ-wise. It seems to be a kind of compensatory act of God that because they might have a difficulty processing information, they're given a little better cognitive ability and a little more clarity of thought so that they can use that to work around and accommodate to their difficulties and make them challenges and not obstacles. But in the zoos that are our classrooms, where teachers must spend half an hour out of an hour of instruction time trying to get the class to listen, how are those kids ever going to get a free, appropriate education of any kind? And what about the kids who don't have troubles? What are they learning? What are they getting? They are getting the shaft, to put it bluntly, out of a misguided, evil ideology that says it's better to be stupid and feel good about yourself than it is to be challenged and have a failure and succeed in spite of it. And that, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, is exactly the philosophy that operates our public schools. You won't hear it expressed by progressives in such clear language, believe me. It'll be wrapped up in candy and ribbons and pretty paper about how compassionate we are and how horrible it is to make children have to suffer through not being A students because they haven't studied and they don't know the material. They'll feel bad, and we can't hold them back because they're getting tall and all their friends are going to the next grade, and it's cruel to not let them go with their friends. What's cruel is to give them a lie and tell them it is a path to success, because it isn't. There's another novel by Robert Heinlein, science fiction novel called Starship Troopers. It was made into a mediocre movie, which I discourage you from watching. Read the book instead. It's quite good. But in the book, in a future society in this country, in order to be a citizen and have voting rights, you have to have served in the military. You have to have been willing to put your beloved body in harm's way for the sake of your fellow citizens. And when you complete your military service, you are then a citizen, and you have the right to vote, the right to be elected to office, etc. And every student in high school has to take a course called History and Moral Philosophy. And that course must be taught by a citizen. And in one episode in the book, the hero, young Johnny Rico, is in his History and Moral Philosophy class. And the teacher is talking about the idea of success and fairness. Because one of the girls said, well, it's not fair that somebody has to compete. Because some people, you know, just can't do something. And he said, okay. The boy did. And the teacher said, oh, not fair, huh? And he walks up to our hero, who runs track, and says, you think it's not fair that, you know, people should have to compete, right? And that everybody should have, you know, the same good stuff. Well, I'm going to, and he takes a piece of paper and writes down, he draws a picture of a blue ribbon and puts first place, and he wheels over to the boy's desk. He's in a wheelchair because he doesn't have any legs. He lost them in military service. And he hands this paper to young Johnny Rico, and he said, here's first prize for the 100-yard dash. You ran it in the field day games. And Johnny says, no, I can't take that. You know darn good and well I only came in third. And the teacher says, no. Here's a certificate. Says you have first prize. You won first prize. Johnny said, no, I didn't win first prize. And the professor looks at him and says, oh, well, that means everybody isn't equal, right? That you had to compete, and you lost, and it made you feel bad. Well, I'm just trying to make you feel good. And young Johnny said, well, it doesn't make me feel good because it isn't true. And all of a sudden, a light bulb goes on. That's exactly what's happening in our public schools, ladies and gentlemen. Our kids are being given a first prize for their existence and not for any achievement. I can't count the number of children that I have dealt with in the 30-plus years I've spent in education, who brought home report cards with A's all over them. Not because they had mastered the material. They were reading 2 to 3 to 5 years below their grade level and doing math at an equally low achievement level. And yet they were getting A's. And they were getting A's because even though they were in seventh grade, the material they were getting A's on was second grade level math and reading. And that is what is happening in our schools still. It started with the establishment of the Department of Education and the legal victory of getting the Americans with Disabilities Act to apply to learning disabilities and hence to public education, to the point that now, if you will look up the Americans with Disabilities Act, the latest version as it applies to education, and look at the list of things that are classified as disabilities, I believe that you will be shocked. That opened the door, ladies and gentlemen. That was one of the openings of the door to dumbing down our population. The goal of the ignorance. Because the ignorance are very easily led and very easily intimidated. And very easily fooled. One of the other battering rams or chisels or pry bars that opened the door to ignorance was the desegregation of schools and the civil rights movement. And most of us don't want to look at this honestly and clearly. Most of us are very worried about being politically incorrect, or being called racist, or being called bigots, or whatever. But when we did one good thing by enacting the Civil Rights Act and giving Americans who happened to be of African descent the equal rights which had been denied them for so many years, we went way overboard and we basically told them, with desegregation and the dumbing down of schools, because it was assumed that since they went to segregated schools, they were ignorant and stupid, we had to make the classes in the integrated schools easier so their self-esteem would not be damaged and they would be equal in achievement to all these brilliant little white kids who'd had the very best educations money could buy. Without paying attention to the fact that there were way more many people like Benjamin Carson than there were ignorant, stupid, dumb black kids who never learned how to read because their school didn't have any books. I know many of you who are conservatives out there know who Dr. Benjamin Carson is. He is the pediatric surgeon who spoke at the prayer breakfast about the stupidity of political correctness and the insanity of the direction this country is headed. He is a conservative. He grew up in a very poor black family. His mother had only a third grade education and could barely read. And yet she made her children take out two or three library books per week and write a book report, and she corrected them. He worked for everything he has. He's a brilliant man. He is not atypical of many, many young black kids who were integrated into white schools in the 1960s. They didn't need the curriculum dumbed down. They just needed to get at it. But oh no, to compensate them for all those years of neglect and poor schools and not sufficient money to hire good teachers, okay? We wanted to give them self-esteem. Well, if anybody's ever really looked at the historical record of people like the Tuskegee Airmen and Martin Luther King, not one of those civil rights marchers wanted anybody to give them self-esteem. They already had it. It was the denial of their right to have the opportunity to exhibit their skills that they were marching for. not give me self-esteem. You don't compensate people for discriminatory treatment by all of a sudden telling them, oh, gee, we're sorry you didn't have good books in school. Here, take this degree from Harvard. When they never even had the chance to attend a class. But, oh, they'll feel good because, look, I can put this in my wall. It says I have a BA from Harvard. But like Johnny Rico's hand-drawn first prize, it doesn't mean doodly squat. And that was the stupid, idiotic, dumb pry bar that opened the door to what we've got now. And it happened again with the Americans with Disabilities Act as it applies to education. Oh, we've got to give these poor children who are handicapped behaviorally or intellectually, their self-esteem will be damaged if they aren't treated equally to everybody else in school. Progressives do not want you to understand that equality under the law and equality of opportunity does not equate to equal outcomes. They want you to believe that equality demands equal outcomes, or as Reverend Sharpton put it, equal stuff in everybody's house. This is the self-esteem versus self-control issue in a nutshell. Self-control is learned. It has to be taught by somebody who already understands it. Self-esteem is earned, and it has to be achieved by meeting challenges and succeeding. Meeting challenges and failing, and then taking the challenge again and again until you do succeed. That is what creates self-esteem. Until we conservatives, who understand the difference between self-esteem and self-control, between equal and alike, between hearing and listening, and between opportunity and outcome, must stand up. We must speak out and be politically incorrect, if that is what it takes, and put on the line our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Just as much as those men who signed that document in that hot meeting room on July 3rd in 1776 in Philadelphia. We have to be willing to wager our lives, literally and figuratively, to stand up for the core values that have made this nation the great land that it is. Silence implies consent, ladies and gentlemen. And if we truly believe that governments derive their just power from the consent of the governed, we cannot be silent because we do not consent to the type of government and what it wants to achieve that we currently have. I, for one, do not wish to live in a communist, socialist, Marxist nation. If I did, I would move to Cuba or Venezuela. I have no plans to change my residence. I'm not seeking a passport to either of those countries. I will run as fast as I can in the other direction to avoid living there. I do not want to live under happy European socialism either. No, I do not want a nice little apartment in Athens, Greece, thank you. And I don't want to live on the Rue de la Paix either, or in London. I want to live in the United States of America. I want to live in the country in which I was born, in which I grew up, and in which I would like to see my children and my grandchildren prosper, be happy, and be blessed. I would like to not outlive my country. When I was young, I never thought the day would come where I would think that I would actually live longer than the country I grew up in. Never did it cross my mind that my country would disappear from beneath my feet and around my mind, body, and soul. It would have been impossible for me to imagine, short of a dark fantasy novel or one of Kurt Vonnegut's stories. It was, you know, titillating and interesting, but you know, dystopian novels weren't all that popular when I was young, because nobody really wanted to imagine living like that. But now, they are becoming more and more the literature of choice of young people. One of the things that I have learned in doing the job that I do is that children need a structured environment because they are children. They are not experienced enough, knowledgeable enough, or grown up enough to be able to create structure for themselves. They do not function well in chaotic situations. They would love to be anarchists, but if you gave them free rein and let them do that, none of them would live long enough to procreate. Children need structure. They need form. Without it, they cannot prosper. They don't have enough knowledge or experience to understand the consequences of what they do. And now they are not being shown in any way that what they do and say even has a consequence to them. I've said before on this show that it amazes and saddens me that 90% of the kids I get in my ISS room tell me that they learn more with me than they do in their regular classes. That is heartbreaking, ladies and gentlemen. That is so upside down. A situation that is supposed to be punishment for these kids for inappropriate behaviors, to many of them, is a wonderful reward. And I really do think some of my repeat offenders deliberately do repeat offend so they can get into ISS and get their work done, or have somebody help them understand it. Now, not all of them, but a few. Most of them do not want to be in ISS. They'd rather be out there with their friends, eating lunch in the cafeteria, talking to them the usual gossip, sitting next to their BFF and giggling and laughing in between classes and being part of the student body. They're at the age that I deal with, they need the group because they haven't really fledged yet. They're taking short hops. They're not ready to soar. And taking those short hops with other fledglings gives them the feeling of safety and comfort. And it gives them ways to understand interactions among people, obscurely and not quite cogently, but they're beginning to understand them. But they need a structure within which to test their wings. If that structure isn't there, they are going to think they're ready to fly off the cliff and wind up smashed to pieces on the rocks below. Very few human beings exist well without some sort of societal structure. We don't have a lot of hermits, ladies and gentlemen. Not only because they went out of fashion after the end of the Middle Ages, but even then there weren't very many of them. We are gregarious beings. We want the company of others of our kind. But because we are also individuals, and we cannot read one another's thoughts or sense one another's emotions, we have made structure and rules so that we can live together with a minimum of bloodshed and a maximum of progress and creativity and comfort for all members of the society. We cannot avoid the fact that we live in a society, and most of us don't want to. We need society. We need community. We need the sense that there are others of our kind nearby with whom we can communicate and exchange ideas and to whom we can turn in times of difficulty or for whom we can offer help when they need it. We need that sense of belonging. It begins with the family, which is the smallest of those groups, and proceeds through Maslow's hierarchy of needs to the community, to the nation, to the world, etc. The sense that we all interact with one another is a part of being human. But we cannot get there if we don't have a logical, sensible, reasonable, moral and ethical structure upon which to build. Our schools were never intended to be substitute parents or substitute ministers or psychiatrists or career counselors or any of the other lovely little things that they are now expected to be. They were intended to be opportunities for people to learn the academic skills that would make them lifetime learners and give them a leg up when they went into the wide world and attempted to earn a living. And to do that, structure is needed. It doesn't have to be restrictive, Victorian, don't speak unless you're spoken to, wear a corset, be whipped if you burp and don't stifle it. We don't need to make our schools into prisons in order to give structure to the kids in which they can learn. But we also do not need to make them into playtime at the monkey house, which is what we've got now. There is a happy medium. There are ways to impose structure that does restrict a child's ability to disrupt other people's learning, but does not restrict that child's ability to question and learn outside the classroom as well as in it. It can be done. Those of you who remember fondly teachers you had in the past, I'll bet you almost every single one of those teachers that you wish you could go back and say thank you to had a structured, fairly strict classroom. Because if they hadn't, you would have learned nothing from them. You would have spent your time playing around, giggling, laughing, you know, shooting pellets at each other, spitballs, you know, eating things, and of course they weren't around at the time, texting your mommy to come and get you because you were bored, or surfing the internet in science class, or whatever it is with their cell phones and iPads and iPhones they do now. You probably revered the teachers most who didn't let you do that, who told you that you were there to listen and learn and ask intelligent questions, and that it wasn't a playground, it was a classroom. And that mutual respect and mutual effort was necessary for both teaching and learning to go on. And they weren't the mean ones who screamed at you and had their pets do a... No, they were the ones who treated everybody with the same degree of strictness and courtesy and caring and attention. And they weren't your best friend. They were your teacher. I address my students in ISS by their last name with Miss or Mr. in front of it. And they always ask me, how come you do that? And I give them one of the reasons. I say to them, I expect you to treat me with respect. And I believe in the golden rule. So I treat you with respect by addressing you as young adults, which you are. They all understand that, and they're okay with it. The second reason, which I don't explain, is because they are not my children, my best friends, my grandchildren, my buddies, my toys, or my pets. They are children. I am an adult. I am not there to be their best friend, their peer, their buddy, their confidant. I am there to be their teacher and, in many cases, their mentor, which is exactly what mentor was to Telemachus, the son of Odysseus. That's where we get the term. Self-control and self-esteem, ladies and gentlemen. The two things must be taught together, and neither can be given. For those of you out there who have kids and grandkids in the public school system, please don't sit on your hands. Please don't make the assumption that all is well when your child brings home a report card with all A's. Please don't blame the teacher if the child gets a D until you've had a chance to talk to that teacher and find out your child's behavior in class and whether or not he or she has turned in assignments or studied for tests. Teachers and parents need to work together, ladies and gentlemen. They are not and should never be adversaries fighting over the poor little bone in a child's clothing. We are not there in the public school to take your child away from you. We are there to do for your child what you do not have the time to do and still hold down a full-time job. You are not there to tell us we are wonderful simply because we put up with your darling little brat. You are there to interact with us and help us give your child the best opportunity we can. We need to work together, ladies and gentlemen, the teaching profession and the parenting profession. And if we do, we will be able to help our children find and achieve self-esteem and self-control. And we will not outlive our country because we will be creating a future that will make it stronger and more free and more creative and more inventive every single year. I want to thank you all for joining us tonight. I hope that you'll come back and see us next Thursday here on Blog Talk Radio for Patriot Education. And please visit us at www.patriotfamilies.com. Read some of our blogs. Follow some of our links. Write a blog yourself. Tell us how you feel. Join us here on Blog Talk every night of the week for a radio show that talks about the things that we are all interested in. Call in. Give us your opinions. Tell us your concerns. Because you are the nation, ladies and gentlemen. It is your consent that will keep the current government in power or create a change in Washington that will really be forward. Have a great evening and a happy Valentine's Day to my audience out there. We'll see you next week at 6 p.m. here on Blog Talk Radio for Patriot Education. Thanks to all my friends in the chat room for coming out tonight. Bill, Linda, Rod, Wing, Dean, everybody who's joined us, thank you for your support. Keep it up, and I know every single one of you out there is going to do his or her best to make sure that none of us outlives our beautiful and wonderful country. Good night, everyone. God bless. Mm-hmm.